Her chestnut hair had been tamed into a dozen pigtails that stuck out from her head in every direction. The kid was going to be a knockout when she grew up. Well, hey, folks, how's it going? Keith Tyler here bringing you the Mystery Hour on Sunsounds of Arizona. A real treat to have you with me. Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine and the pseudonymed author Charlie Marsh brings us our first story. A little bit out of season, but you know, when it's 100 and whatever here in Phoenix, it's time to have something a little bit cooler. The story is called Streets of Joy. Cooper wrapped the faded quilt tighter around his body and tried to ignore the breeze blowing through the cracks around the edges of the bedroom's rattling windows. Snow ticked lightly against the glass, making the room feel colder. The old steam radiator hissed and clanked as it failed to keep up with the winter storm that had descended on the city nearly 24 hours before, shutting down all but the dingy neighborhood bars that never seemed to close. 4 hours of sleep was nowhere near enough. He had just managed to doze off again when a knock sounded on the door. "Go away!" There was no one he wanted to see, no one he expected to see.
"Mr. Cooper,"
called a woman's voice. "I said go away." The knocking continued, a strangely rhythmic staccato on his solid wooden door. The rest of the two-room bedsit might be falling down around his ears, but he swore that door would last forever. Oh, man. Cooper rolled off the thin mattress and onto his feet, wrapped the quilt around his shoulders, and shuffled barefoot across the rough wooden floor. He yanked open the door and scowled at the two people standing there. "What? What is so damned important?"
"Mr. Cooper, please, language."
Shauna Wright frowned at him and covered her young daughter's ears. Cooper gave his upstairs neighbor a hard stare before lowering his gaze to the 6-year-old firecracker who couldn't have weighed more than 30 pounds. He had managed to sound like a linebacker when stomping around overhead.
"Hi, Mr. Cooper."
The firecracker gave him a gap-toothed smile. Hazel eyes bright with interest, her chestnut hair had been tamed into a dozen pigtails that stuck out from her head in every direction. Kid was going to be a knockout when she grew up. "It's just Cooper," he corrected for the 1,000th time. Shauna ignored him again.
I'm sorry, Mr. Cooper, but I'm desperate. Amy's bus has been delayed, and Mr. Finley insists I come in to serve breakfast or he'll fire me. I can't take Rose with me. Could you watch her until Amy gets home?"
Cooper narrowed his eyes at Rose. What he knew about children could fit inside a shot glass. He'd rather serve breakfast at Finley's. He opened his mouth to say just that, but Rose was already inside. Shauna gave him a warm smile and thrust a pink backpack into his chest. He grabbed it without thinking.
"Oh, thank you. I'll bake you some cookies when I get home."
"I don't like Too late. She was gone. Cooper turned to stare at Rose, who had already removed her coat and hat and boots and left them in a heap by the door. She surveyed his living room and kitchen, inspecting the sparse furnishings with a slight moo of disgust that looked better suited for an adult's face, and finally settled on the sagging couch. His scowl deepened.
"Where's your tree?"
"What do I need a tree for?"
"Well, you could put the presents you give to your friends under it. Besides, how will Santa know where to leave your presents if you don't have a tree?"
"Kid, you got a lot to learn. Stay here while I get dressed."
"You're already dressed,"
Rose pointed out. He slept in long thermal underwear, If he didn't, he'd have been frozen to death by now. I need to dress my feet. He retired to the bedroom and shut the door behind him. He held no hope that Amy's bus would arrive, not the way it had been snowing all night. He had things to do, and babysitting was not one of them. What the hell was he supposed to do with the kid all day? Not trusting that she would stay where he left her, he remembered to shut the bathroom door while he took a leak. He searched his reflection in the cracked mirror over the toilet, but nothing had changed. A reporter once described his face as creased and droopy, as if the things he had witnessed have weighed him down so much he's given up trying to hold it in place. Yeah, the words were truer than he cared to admit. Another knock sounded as he pulled insulated coveralls over his underwear. He grabbed his heavy socks and hurried to answer it. Perhaps Amy had made it home after all. Do not open that door. Rose took her small hand from the deadbolt. You have company. Doubtful. Move away from the door. There was no telling who would be on the other side, and he didn't want to have to explain to Shauna that the kid had gotten in the way of a fist or a knife. He waited until she retreated to the couch, trying and failing to ignore the hurt expression on her face, and scowled even more fiercely because he wasn't going to let this little spitfire get to him. He turned back to the door. Who is it? Silence. I said, who is it? I'm not opening this door until you answer.
Mabel.
The rest was lost in mumble. Mabel, a street person of indeterminate age, never entered a building if she could help it. She claimed she felt too confined when inside. She was one of the more lucid street people Cooper dealt with. Only something serious could force her to his door. He slapped back the deadbolt and opened the door. Eh, what's wrong? No point in beating around the bush. Cooper knew from experience that the more time Mabel spent indoors, the less coherent she became.
And Goose is missing.
Blue jeans peeked out from beneath the bedraggled, dirt-stained flounce of Mabel's flannel nightgown. Like many street dwellers, she wore multiple layers of clothing. A three-quarter length men's wool coat engulfed her round form. Her fingers, exposed in the fingerless gloves she favored, plucked and danced at her side. Behind her stood the wheelie cart that held her worldly possessions. Cooper didn't judge. He lived barely a half-step better than citizens like Mabel. How long? The fingers began to jerk.
Last night. On Wednesday? We picked Deering Street on Wednesday. We started at opposite ends, meet in the middle.
Her fingers flashed.
We switch ends because it's only fair. Some houses are better picking than others.
What happened?
Goose never met me. I checked his sleeping spot. He never showed.
Cooper nodded. Could he have found a half-empty bottle? He, of all people, knew how a person could get lost in a bottle. Mabel shook her head.
Nah, Goose doesn't drink. I have to go. You'll look for him?
Yeah, I'll look. Soon as I can.
Usual fee? Don't wait too long.
He missed his insulin shot this morning. Mabel grabbed the wheelie's handle and hurried down the hall, one wheel squeaking. The urge to stop her and lubricate the wheel was strong, but Cooper resisted. Mabel had reached her indoor limit. He'd have to get the wheel another time. He wondered what half-broken item she'd pull from the cart to pay him with. When he turned around, he saw that Rose had put on her jacket and boots and was digging through the small pink backpack. Crayons and a coloring book, a Christmas storybook, and a small stuffed dog with one ear were spread across the couch.
All right, just where do you think you're going?
She pulled a pair of mittens from the bottom of the backpack with a triumphant smile.
We have to go look for your friend.
He's not He didn't do friends, but if he did, the street people were the closest he came. Rose pulled on her hat and mittens and waited by the door.
Goose needs you. You can't leave me here alone, so I have to come with you to help you look.
Cooper hated that the kid was right. Goose missing was troubling, especially with the spate of recent deaths among the city's homeless population. Mabel had a legitimate reason to be worried. He pointed a finger at her. You have to do what I say, and no arguing. He didn't trust the grin she gave him, not one little bit. 5 minutes later, Cooper was striding over the cobbled streets in his waterfront neighborhood with Rose on his shoulders. She wore a windbreaker over her winter coat, the end of the sleeves in fat puffy rolls up to her tiny mittens. He'd tied a clean pair of long underwear around her neck and lower face while she giggled, doing his best to make her cold-proof. The snow still fell, albeit slower, and the wind has died. The flakes were bigger, which meant the air was beginning to warm, and the day had lightened to a cold pewter gray. A fluffy coat of white softened the old red-brick buildings and hid the cars parked along the streets. He walked in the snowy street, the usual city traffic absent. A tomcat yowled in a nearby alley. A street plow rumbled up near the city center, its yellow lights flashing. A few industrious tenants were already out shoveling the sidewalks in front of their buildings. Several wished him a good morning. Cooper was content to let Rose answer. Deering Street, where Goose had last been seen, lay on the opposite side of the peninsula and one street down from Congress Street, which followed the elevated spine of the city. As they climbed the gradual rise, Rose's muffled chatter faded into background. A police car traveled toward them on the empty streets, slowed down and flashed its lights. Cooper gave a half wave and kept walking. He considered the unusual number of deaths among the homeless over the previous 5 days. While winter was typically hard on the street dwellers, this December's weather had been relatively mild up until the previous night's snowstorm, and therefore couldn't be blamed for the increase in deaths.
Oh, Mr. Cooper, look so pretty! Rose kicked her boots against Cooper's chest in excitement.
The art school, which had taken over one of the city's oldest and largest department store buildings, had turned the large display windows into scenes from beloved Christmas classics.
It's the Grinch!
Rose pointed at the window with a strange green creature, a sleigh filled with wrapped presents, and a little dog.
And Rudolph!
Rose's hands patted Cooper's head in time with naming all of Santa's reindeer.
I love Christmas.
Her tone changed, became wistful.
I hope Amy can get home. We're supposed to decorate our tree tonight.
Your tree isn't up? He was surprised. With a child in the house, he assumed Shauna would be on top of all that Christmas hoorah.
Yeah, Mama needs a few more tips before we can buy a tree. Amy needed new boots because her feet grew, and boots are more important than a tree.
Rose didn't sound upset or disgusted that Amy's feet grew. She sounded matter-of-fact, like sacrificing for unexpected expenses was an expected part of life. For the first time, Cooper considered the private life of a single mother earning a low wage and trying to provide a safe home for her children. They crossed over the eerily empty main street and headed one block west to Deering Street. Mabel had told him that Goose had taken the far end of Deering, so he walked to the middle of the four-block street and began his search. Cooper knew that Goose would not have taken off on Mabel. The pair had developed a bond when they met 3 years earlier and had stuck together since, watching each other's backs. Deering Street boasted large, old brick buildings that once housed Portland's upper class. Its residences long since broken up into duplexes and apartments, the neighborhood still retained its privileged air. Every building had a side yard, most enclosed by a short wrought iron fence. In anticipation of the snow, the trash bins Goose and Mabel were searching had been brought in. Because of the city's parking ban, cars lined only one side of the street. Lights were on in many of the buildings as the residents prepared for their day. The sound of a shovel scraping against a brick sidewalk 2 blocks away rang clearly in the silent world. The smell of coffee, grease, and sugar wafted from Dunkin' Donuts on Congress Street, making Cooper's stomach growl. When had he last eaten? Despite feeling hungry, he'd been too tired to whip up anything when he got in, falling face down on his bed instead. Cooper stood in the middle of the street and wondered what to do. Rose had grown silent. What sort of trauma would he introduce to the child if they found Goose dead and frozen in the snow? He should take her back and look for Goose later when Shauna finished work.
"We have to look for Goose," Rose said, as if reading his thoughts. "He might be hurt and need our help."
Cooper agreed. He plowed through the 3-foot-deep snowbank and into the sidewalk, none of which had been cleared. If Goose had been checking trash bins, he would have done it from the walk and not the street. He spotted a dark boot sticking out of a pile of snow half under a large pine in the next yard and knew they'd found Goose. Turning away, he pulled his cheap cell from an inside chest pocket and hit number 1 on speed dial. "Found another one." He slipped the phone back into the pocket. "Rose?"
"Did we find Goose?"
The kid's intelligence spooked him. No 6-year-old should have anything to do with dead bodies. Yeah, we found him. A policewoman is on her way. I want you to wait for me in her car where it will be warmer."
"Okay."
Just like that. Okay. He relaxed slightly. Maybe he was better at this kid thing than he'd thought.
"Can I flash the lights and make the siren go?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Because."
"Mama says because is no answer. I want to stay with you."
"I need you to stay in the car." He did not want Rose to see Goose when they dug him out.
"You're supposed to be watching me. You can't watch me in the car."
And maybe he sucked at the kid thing, if a 6-year-old could outmaneuver him. Before he could argue further, a police car pulled up beside them, and a woman dressed in a puffy dark blue down parka climbed out. Despite not being able to see her face, Cooper could feel Rose's delight over seeing a female cop.
"Simmons, thanks for coming so quickly."
He worked with Detective Simmons several times over the last year and knew her to be good at her job, good enough to earn her the first number on his speed dial.
"Where?"
"Over there under the pine. Goes by the name of Goose. In decent health when I saw him last a few nights ago." He took a deep breath, huffed it out in a white cloud. I should have been out here. I might have stopped it." Simmons narrowed her eyes.
"You've been burning the candle at both ends for a week now. Hate to break it to you, but even Superman has to sleep sometimes."
The sky had eased from now, from deep pewter to pale gray, and the snow had stopped.
"I'll call it in. Go home, Coop. We'll talk later."
"Right." Cooper headed back toward Congress Street and Dunkin' Donuts. He could use a cup of hot coffee, and they had hot chocolate for the kid. He really should get Rose back to the apartment in case Amy came home. But he couldn't. Not just yet. "I have something I need to do before we go home," he told Rose, watching her carefully spoon a tiny marshmallow from her chocolate and slurp it up with a satisfied smile. The coffee shop windows were steamed up, the floor muddied with clumps of melting snow and dirt. Several regulars sat at the counter, talking in low voices. The sole waitress stared at her phone and snapped gum while she waited for another customer to walk in. Rose turned her killer eyes on him.
"Are we going to look for someone else? Do you need to find Mabel and tell her Goose is dead?
How do you know? Never mind." These days, children were exposed to violence on TV and in movies and video games at a young age. He thought it was a travesty, but he couldn't stop it.
Yes, we need to look for someone else, but not Mabel. Mabel could wait. He didn't want to tell her Goose was dead without knowing how the man had died. Who are we looking for now?
His name is Milo. Drink up. We need to get going.
Rose had stripped off all the outerwear while he was getting their drinks. Suppressing a sigh, Cooper began the process of making her as weatherproof as he could. Finally, they stood outside, Rose riding his shoulders once again. He didn't want to admit that her presence felt strangely, well, comforting.
Which way? Well, he'd spent most of the night searching for Milo with no luck. His father avoided the homeless shelters, declaring them cesspools of germs and crazies. Like Mabel, Milo preferred the outdoors.
Deering Oaks Park. The location came to him unbidden. Unlike bridges over well-traveled streets, the park not only had a wide stone bridge to sleep under, the children's playground equipment could also be used for shelter. He headed west toward the park, taking the sidewalks where they were cleared and the plowed high street when they weren't. The kid seemed to sense his need to concentrate and ceased her chatter. He'd been searching for his father for 2 days now with increasing worry. Someone had begun smothering street people while they slept or were too out of it on drugs or booze to defend themselves. 4 dead in 5 days, and now Goose. Milo, once a respected police detective, had lost everything to the bottle. Rather than continue to be a drag on his wife and 14-year-old son, he'd had packed a small canvas backpack with a change of clothes and walked out 15 years before. Cooper had found him by chance one day when tracking down a missing teenaged girl. He'd found the girl living in a one-room slum with her loser boyfriend. The girl had been only too happy to be forced to go home. Cooper had made a point of tracking down his father at least once a week. After that, and offering him a little money or a hot meal. Sometimes his father accepted. More often, he refused. Whether because of shame or pride, Cooper couldn't guess. They were two sides of the same coin. It really didn't matter. As long as Milo lived on the streets, Cooper, he'd do what he could to protect him. The storm had turned the 55-acre park into a winter wonderland, frosting the trees in white and covering the land in undulating waves of snow. They found 2 homeless men sleeping under the stone bridge. Cooper woke them and asked after Milo. One told him to try the playground and asked for money for food. Cooper slipped him a 10, knowing full well that little of it would go to nourish the man's stomach. The plows had yet to clear the park road, so Cooper headed cross-country, taking the most direct route to the children's playground. The snow reached to his knees in the open, and he was soon sweating under his insulated overalls.
"I see someone," Rose said excitedly.
She'd been quiet since they entered the park. Cooper had grown so used to her weight on his shoulders, he'd almost forgotten she was there.
"Where?" "Over by the slide."
Cooper swerved in that direction and saw a man kneeling in the snow by the bottom of the slide. His build didn't look right for Milo, but he could ask after the old man. The closer he drew, the odder the scene became. There was a second man lying under the slide, batting feebly at the kneeling man. But hindered by the slide over his head, it wasn't until they were almost on top of them that Cooper understood what was happening. He whipped Rose off his shoulders and set her on the top of the slide. "Stay there." The kneeling man went down easily under his tackle.
"Doc," Cooper said, surprised.
No one knew if Doc had truly been a doctor. It was his street name, accepted by all. Excited brown eyes looked back at him.
"Oh, get off me, Coop. I need to help him sleep."
Cooper glanced at his father gasping for air under the slide. When he looked back at Doc, still on his back,
why do you help him sleep?
Doc shook his head and looked determined.
"Winters are too hard for them, Coop. It's better if they go to sleep and don't wake up. I help them
They need me. Coop, let me up.
Cooper stared at Doc for a long minute before putting his knee on the man's chest to hold him while he took out his phone.
Simmons, I have your murderer. We're at the Oaks playground.
He ended the call and put away his phone, but remained kneeling on Doc's chest.
Milo, you okay?
Yeah, maybe,
his voice rasped.
I thought I saw you carrying a small child.
The kid chose that moment to plow her way down the slide. She ignored Doc and crawled beneath the slide.
Are you Mr. Milo? My name is Rose. Mama and Amy and me live upstairs from Mr. Coopy. Did you really sleep here in the snow?
Rose, Cooper warned. Is she yours, Coop? Gonna be a knockout when she grows up. You'll have your hands full protecting her.
No, Dad, she's not mine. Rose might not be his, but something told him his father was right. He was going to have his hands full protecting her. A siren pierced the quiet. A plow that had been following it cleared the park road by the playground, and Detective Simmons pulled up, followed by a second cruiser. She joined them by the slide.
Caught him in the act, huh? That's great, Cooper. We'll take it from here.
She gestured to the cops from the second car to take Doc away. Bending at the waist, she looked at the man under the slide.
Well, Mr. Milo, I've heard a lot about you. I'm glad you're all right, sir. If you'd like to come with me, I can get your statement and take you to a shelter after that.
Very kind of you, Detective, but no thank you.
She straightened, and the look she gave Milo said she wasn't going to argue about it now.
Tomorrow will be soon enough to come down to the station and file your report,
she told Cooper.
Bring your father with you. Meanwhile, go home. Get some sleep.
She headed back to the car, but turned before she reached it.
And Cooper, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, Detective.
Cooper turned his attention back to Milo and Rose and found the pair sizing one another up.
Dad?
Milo.
Cooper suppressed a sigh. Milo, tonight is Christmas Eve. Spend the night with me. I have a couch.
It's pretty lumpy, Rose pointed out.
Cooper glared at her.
You aren't helping.
Milo smiled. Had he ever seen his father smile? Cooper searched his memory, but came up blank.
You know, the couch might be just the ticket.
Milo rolled out the opposite side of the slide and stood. He pulled the canvas backpack, now stained and worn through in spots, onto one shoulder. Cooper had no clue why, after years of asking his father to stay with him and being turned down every time, the old man decided to say yes. It didn't matter, he realized. At least for tonight, he'd know his father had shelter and was safe.
Come on.
Up you go, kid. He settled the familiar weight on his shoulders and jerked his head toward the road.
Ready? He asked his father.
Lead on, Macbeth.
His name's Mr. Cooper. Did you forget already?
A strange, creaky sound escaped both men's lips. When had he last laughed? Certainly before Milo had left. Cooper glanced sideways at his father and saw a wide smile on the old man's face. The kid had done the impossible. She had given them both something to smile about.
Mr. Cooper?
Yes, Rose.
Now will you get a tree?
Well, how about this? Why don't we get a tree for your place and surprise your mother? Silence greeted his suggestion.
Rose?
Well, then we'll need two trees, Mr. Cooper. Don't worry, I'll help you pick a good one.
Cooper suppressed a smile. The kid was going to run circles around him if he wasn't careful.
All right, Rose, just this once, we'll get two trees.
It was a small price to pay for the sound of his father's laugh.
Thank you.
Moving on to our next story from the Playboy Book of Crime and Suspense, a story by Gilbert Wright, The Room of Dark. In my country, when two fellows become angry enough to kill the other because of a lady or some matter, it is the custom to arrange a duel. From such a duel as we arrange, the trouble between these two fellows will be settled, believe me. The committee for duels prepares a house in one room so that on the closing of the door, the room is dark. Fine sand without little stones is spread over the floor to the depth of a span. The bare feet of a man make not the smallest sound walking on such a floor. The two fellows are made naked. Each has a knife, nothing more. The committee puts one fellow in a corner of the room, and across from him, in that corner, the other fellow. And in one of the other two corners, the committee puts a live rattlesnake of good size. The committee retires, the door is shut quickly, the duel now begins. Outside, the people wait for the half of 1 minute. If the winner has not come out by that time, the committee piles empty oil cans against the door completely over the top. The people now go about their affairs, because it may be many hours, even 2 or 3 days, before the winner opens the door and makes the cans crash down. The crashing down of the cans will be heard day or night, all over the village, and the people may now go to see which fellow has come out. If it should happen that the duel is over in the half of 1 minute, it will be because one of the fellows rushed. You see, on the closing of the door, there will be a very short time when you can still have the image of your enemy in the mind's eye. You can rush straight across the room to his position and perhaps finish him. But you must act very fast before the image goes. Both fellows could rush, but I have not heard of it. Most often the rush is not made, and so the cans are piled up. The duel is now an affair of patience, great care, and much thought. Each fellow seeks to find the other without making his own presence known. One smart fellow may think of a method to work a trick on the other, but if the trick is not completely successful, it will be the smart fellow who remains behind in the room of dark. Much will depend on the control of the mind, because after some hours in complete dark, the mind can grow unreliable, and a fellow may do something foolish and so inform his enemy of his position. Because of thirst and the growing bad air, after 3 days, one of the fellows is pretty sure to lose control. He may talk to himself or even sing, and should this happen, it will not be that fellow who crashes down the cans. There are reasons for putting the rattlesnake into the room of dark. It is of great danger to both men, equally, not caring who it might bite. We also believe that the snake will make the fellow who is most afraid even more fearful, so that the braver fellow has a better chance to win. Many times, we believe the snake will prevent a duel. Fellows quick to fight, if the snake were not to be with them, may think of a way to settle their quarrel without the duel. But if the anger of two fellows to kill the other is strong enough, they will duel, even if more than one snake would be put into the room. Such an anger was between Damundo and Pito. Both these fellows were my cousins, because in our village, if a fellow is not your brother, he is certainly to be your cousin. Damundo is a cousin not liked by me and others. He is more than 30, dark, strong, and rough, much hair and a mustache that he trims like a lady's little eyebrow. Damundo has the strong belief that he is a great victor over men and girls. In this there is truth. 5 times in not 2 years he has dueled, and each time it was he who crashed down the cans. Never did he receive even a small wound, and the times of his winnings were never more than an hour, often less. A thing unheard of in history. He brags that only cowards take the time of 2 or 3 days.
Ridiculous. Damundo gets hungry. Damundo misses his girl. Every year he goes working on a ship for 2 months, and on his return from foreign places, he brings presents of bracelets, necklaces, shining chains to hang from the waist, ribbons, combs, candies, lipsticks, perfumes, and other delights. Pito is a cousin much liked by me and others. He is slim and has a mustache of first growth, which he does not yet trim or it would be gone. Pito is 3 years older than me, and the feeling has come upon him that he is no longer a boy. His voice has become deep, but is not yet dependable to remain so. Several girls of our village notice him, but when we all go out upon the beach at low tide to gather the harvest of the shore, Pito digs with Angia, and their hands meet together under the sand. Angia is some younger than Pito, and has much charm. She smiles softly and does not scream and produce silly laughing like those young girls who want only to bring you embarrassment. This day, Pito and Angia and I dug together. Damundo came up to stand looking down at Angia. We did not show we knew he was there, but dug, putting the small clams into one basket. Damundo dropped a little bottle of shining glass and gold into the sand before Angia's hands. She looked at it, but did not look up. She then dug to one side of the little bottle. We dug, putting the clams into our one basket. Damundo squatted. He took up the bottle and twisted out the stopper. There was a strong, sweet smell, the smell of some foreign flower. Damundo held the little bottle close to Angia. We stopped digging and sat back from our knees because something would now happen. Angia took the bottle and put back the stopper. Then she gave it to Pito. Pito stood. Damundo stood. Pito offered him back the little bottle, and Damundo struck it from his hand. He said, "I, Damundo, gave that foreign perfume to Angia for a present, little boy." "I give the presents to Angia," said Pito. "I only." His voice being very deep, but went suddenly like a young boy's, Pito's face was red with shame, but he stood looking Damundo hard in the eyes. Damundo laughed and laughed at Pito. He laughed loud, and others around us who were digging looked. Soon, many stood. Damundo stopped laughing, his face now strong with anger. "So," he said, "so you think to give the present to Angia? Only you listen, little boy, I will tell you something. Angia has come to the notice of a man." "I am that man," said Pito, and his voice remained deep. Pito's mother came hurrying and scolding as if she did not know of the growing trouble. She ordered us home. We had enough clams. It was late. Pito should go to the hunt the cow. She took his arm and pulled. "Make haste, my child." Pito shook away her hand, looking straight at Damundo. Damundo stepped close to Pito and placed his hand on Angia's shoulder. "So," he said to Pito, "so you are that man?" And Pito was. He spat in Damundo's face. Then, as was the custom, a friend of Damundo's led him one way, and I, being Pito's friend, led him another way. Angia stood where we had dug, looking down at the little bottle shining in the sand. She put down her hand for it. I and some of my family were at the house of Pito. I began to sharpen his knife, a thing at which I am good. Not much was said. The duel, which would begin next day at noon, was not talked of. We had come to be with Pito and his people to show friendship. Then came Pito's father with three old uncles. Each long ago had been winner in a duel, and it had hoped that Pito might learn a little from them. You see, it is not right to ask a young man who has crashed down the cans how he did his winning. He may have to fight again, and so does not want his method known. But with old men, they will not fight again. They do not mind to talk of their winning. "When the door is shut, Pito," said Uncle Chaco, who is thin and trembles, "squat down very quickly in your corner. Hold your knife point up, thus. If Damundo rushes, His image in your mind will see you standing. He will strike too high, then you must rise into him.
Old Uncle Kantu, who is blind, said strongly,
No, Pito, you must leave an image of more deception. As the door closes, move the left foot. Damundo will think you are stepping out of your corner. He will rush to the left of it, but you will remain in your corner. You can get him when he arrives.
Damundo will not rush, said old Uncle Juan, who speaks thick because of the right side of his mouth does not move.
Damundo has never rushed.
But he will do something very soon, said old Uncle Chaco. He is known for the short times of his winnings. He will not lessen his reputation by delay, not Damundo.
Then, if he does not rush, said old Uncle Kantu, he will come along the wall. He will count his steps by placing the heel and toe together. There are 15 of such steps to each wall of the room. He will come quickly and without sound. When the count of his steps brings him to where he thinks you to be, Pito will strike. Pito, he will strike.
But because Pito moved his left foot, said old Uncle Chaco,
Damundo will expect him to be a little out of his corner to the left. He will strike at that count. You, Pito, will hear nothing, but you may feel a little fan of air stirred up by his empty blow. Strike in the direction of the air, to the right of it, my boy.
Do not forget the snake, said old Uncle Juan.
Damundo will not come by way of the corner where the snake was put down.
You may be sure of that, Pito, said old Uncle Kantu. If Damundo comes measuring steps along the wall, he will come by way of the corner across from the stake. You will then know the direction of his approach to you.
Never delude yourself, Pito, said old Uncle Juan, that you know what Damundo will do. It is good to leave an image of deception. But how can you know where you have left it? The door might close so quickly that the movement of your foot will not be seen by Damundo.
My advice to you is to stay close to the wall at all times. Then you will at least know where something is. That will be a comfort.
What? Said old Uncle Chaco, trembling greatly. Stay close to the wall? Oh, no. The snake will come along the wall. He will go all the way around the room, keeping close to the wall. He sees a hole through which he may escape. The snake will meet you if you choose to stay close to the wall. Pito, then he will rattle and Damundo will know your position.
To see and I must have some light, said old Uncle Kantu. The snake will rattle not because he sees you, Pito, but because he feels the heat from your naked body. This frightens him, and the trembling of his tail sends forth the rattle. At any time you hear the rattle, you will know that either you or Damundo is close to the snake.
Ah, this need not be so, said old Uncle Juan.
Lie down, Pito, your feet against the wall and your body into the room. You will know where you are, but your feet against the wall. Now cover your feet, legs, and all but the chest and arms with sand. When the snake comes along the wall, he will crawl over you without rattling. The heat of your body will not come through the sand, and should Damundo be close by, the snake will rattle at him.
More can be done with sand, said old Uncle Chaco. Mound the sand against one ear. It will happen that if Damundo moves by stepping, crawling, or in any manner, he will disturb the grains of sand under his weight. These grains will pass on the disturbance to other grains and they to still other grains, so that the disturbance will come to you that you have mounted over your ear. You will know that Damundo moves.
But not where he moves, said old Uncle Kantu.
To discover Damundo's direction, both ears must be mounted over with sand.
But with both ears in the sand, said Uncle Juan, you will not hear the rattle of the snake. His tail is in the air and does not disturb grains of sand. The rattle may bring you information of importance, Pito. Surely do not cover both ears with sand.
It is important, Pito, said Uncle Chaco, to keep account of the time. This may be done by the sound of the village. Cows asking to be milked at sundown, dogs howling at moonrise, roosters calling at dawn. In this way, my winning was helped.
After the second calling of the cows, I thought it reasonable to try to deceive my enemy by sounds of sleep. I came back along the wall a little way from my corner, and facing the corner, cupped my hands around my mouth and against the wall, leaving a small opening to detect the sound. I made sounds of sleep, not too often, not too loud. The sounds echoed from the opposite wall of my corner. My enemy came to stab me there. His knees brushed me. I had no confusion in placing my knife.
On the second day, said old Uncle Juan, my enemy began to talk to me in whispers. He said that we were fools, that the trouble between us was not of the importance to cost the life of either. He proposed that we go along the walls, find the door, and crash down the cans together. I did not accept this proposal, neither did I altogether reject it. In this way, we came to the door, and I had my success.
I have often wondered if he made his proposal with honest intent.
Never believe, said old Uncle Cantu, that the snake must rattle before it strikes. Always, if you move, keep the body low. More heat will go to the snake, and it will rattle the sooner. If you move standing, the snake may feel the small, quick heat of your stepping foot and strike before he has time to grow fearful and rattle. I believe it was thus that I came to crash down the cans. Never did I hear the snake rattle, but the first calling of the rooster, I began to hear the dying of my enemy. After some hours, these sounds ceased. I came out of the room of dark because I no longer had an enemy.
The old uncles thought for a time, thinking if more could be said. By now I had made Pito's knife very sharp with the stone and with the leather. I honed it upon my palm. I looked to see if Pito had received confidence from the wisdom of the uncles.
If the duel should continue to the time of the bad air, said old Uncle Cantu, stand tall and lift the face. There will be better air above than below.
You are young, Pito, and therefore supple, said old Uncle Chaco. Still, do not remain long without some small movement of the limbs. The knee joints give snaps of sound if allowed to become set.
If it happens that you make some such sound, said old Uncle Juan, move quickly from the place where you made it.
That boy is young, said old Uncle Cantu. He has not defiled his body by smoke and drink and the numberless dissipations of Damundo. Pito's senses are alert and clear. In this case, he has a great advantage.
After a long thinking, old Uncle Chaco said, 5 times has this Damundo won, never with a wound, never with more time than an hour.
Damundo, said old Uncle Cantu, is a foolish and reckless man, too much confidence. In addition, he has had much luck.
To have had such luck, said old Uncle Juan, seems beyond the possible.
But if not luck, what then? Said old Uncle Cantu.
A method, said old Uncle Juan. Damundo has a method of perfection.
After this, the old uncles said nothing, not thinking of more to say. Old Uncle Juan went to sleep a little.
Pito looked to me, and we stood and walked away together.
I gave him his knife, and he whistled at its sharpness. Indeed, I can sharpen a knife. I had twice seen the knife of Damundo, an evil foreign thing, with a jeweled handle and hooked blade. I told Pito I believed that Damundo would not strike down with such a knife, but rip up with the hook. Also to cheer Pito, and this was true. I said that his knife was longer than Damundo's, by a finger's breadth at least. I was certain of it.
Pito smiled a little. Of one thing we may be sure, good friend of mine, you have made my knife sharper than any knife in the world. There can be no doubt of it.
We came to the tall tree by the village well. Many times I have climbed this tree with Pito. From that high branches one can see the tops of the distant mountains that rise from the far edge of the sea.
Pito, I said, do you truly feel yourself to be a man?
He was angry. Did I not show it upon the beach?
On the last word of his voice changed into the voice of a young boy. Ashamed, Pito ran off. By noon, the committee had prepared the room. The sun was bright and shone fully on the house, and all who desired went in and closed the door to inspect if the room was truly dark. Two sparks of sun were seen in the roof, and a boy was sent with soft mud to the top of the house. Those inside tapped with a cane at the places where the light and the boy stopped them with mud. All came out, saying that the room was now truly dark. A fellow had come with a rattlesnake of good size in a sack. A member of the committee shook the sack roughly, and the snake rattled well. Domundo stood with two friends at the north of the door. He was laughing and talking, not so all must hear, but so all could hear. He said that he would be glad to go into the room of dark. It was cool in there, away from the sun. He would take a nap, because he had drunk much the night before. After awakening, he would take a moment for the business of the day and then crash down the cans. Domundo had plans for the evening. Pito and his friends stood at the south of the door. It was as the custom. None of us talked one word. Angia came, beautiful in her best dress. Naturally, she had not been seen by anyone since Pito had insulted Domundo on the beach. She had remained in her house, and as was the custom, but now it was also the custom that she must come and look long at Pito, and then go and look long at Domundo also. When she came to Pito, she did not come very close. She stood looking at him, and it was as though she had put something in her face for him to understand. There was something there to see, if one knew it. I did not. She did not smile. Then she went to Domundo. Her back was toward us, and her face could not be seen as she looked at him. Domundo suddenly smiled big and put both of his hands on her shoulders, and she put both her hands on his head. Then she turned and went back to her house. Domundo called, "Tonight, little one, do not change your clothes. I like that dress." We could not believe it, for with us, when a man puts his hands on a girl's shoulders and she smooths her hands on his head, it is a greeting of lovers. It means, "I am glad you are here." It can also mean farewell, as when lovers part for a time. So thinking that Pito would be killed, she has now chosen Domundo because it would be he who would come out of the room of dark? But what cruelty to let Pito see! Now he must go in with no hope of her, no strength of love to fight with. Pito would be killed for nothing. Domundo, waving his hand and kissing it, went to the room with the committee. Pito went in with one smile for his mother and for us. One man, the head of the committee, now went inside with the snake. Soon he came out and tossed the empty sack aside. He put his hand on the door and called, "Farewell to one of you," and shut the door. All waited for the half of 1 minute. Nothing happened. Then began the piling of the empty cans against the door, but before the cans were halfway, a scream came from the room of dark. It was the voice of Pito. People talked of Pito's scream. Some said it was a scream of pain. Others were not sure of this. Another boy and I thought it Pito had given more of a yell, a cry of angry hate. Our talk decided nothing. Many people beside Pito's family stayed all night before the door. Angia waited too, but apart from everyone, and no one spoke to her. When morning came, I went with my mother to our house, she to get us something to eat, I to put our cow into the field. Our house is a little distance from the village, but as I was fastening the wire of the gate, I heard the crashing down of the cans. I ran with all my power, but when I got to the room of dark, Pito was already dressed, and the committee was examining the method of Domundo. The handle of his knife was hollow, and the jeweled plate at the butt unscrewed. It was in the handle that Domundo kept a light of electricity. The light was no bigger than a thumb, but in the room of dark, strong and blinding. There is no trouble to kill a man if you are behind such a light. The flashing on of the light caused Pito to scream out in anger. Then he had reached down quickly and thrown a handful of sand at the light. The sand went into Domundo's eyes. He turned off the light because now being blinded, the light was of danger to him. Also, it was believed that he dropped the light. It was found in another part of the room from where Pito and Domundo had at last met. Of the meeting, Pito had not much to say. The snake had rattled for him, as he thought. He had not moved. The snake went away, not rattling hard. Then suddenly it rattled loud again. The snake must be now rattling at Domundo. This was all that Pito would say.
"But you were close to the wall, Pito," said Uncle Juan.
"Your senses were alert and clear," said old Uncle Cantu.
"Damundo was close. He must moved because of the snake. You heard him."
"It is plain that you were close together and that you knew his direction because of the snake," said old Uncle Chaco.
"But how, Pito, could you know just when to strike, just where to strike?"
"When I am old, my uncles," said Pito, "I will speak of how I came to crash down the cans, if the occasion is of importance, but that will be many years." He went to where Angia stood, beautiful with smiles, and only I heard what they said.
"It was long, Angia," said Pito, "before it came to my mind why you made the greeting with him."
He brought her hands to his face and smiled.
"You have washed them well."
"Very well, man of this heart."
"Good," said Pito. "The perfume of that foreign flower I never want to smell again." And they walked away toward the sea.
All right, friends, Romans, countrymen, thanks for lending me your ear. Keith Tyler saying, tune in again next time to the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks. Make sure your I love yous are in order. So long.